yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well.
This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, the topic today, I was going to talk about this McKinsey report that, you know, McKinsey is this big corporate consulting firm, just put out last week, in which it talks about what it calls the great attrition. You know, that's what they call the fact that workers aren't coming back to work, the great attrition, or a favorite term before that was the great resignation, as if, you know, people are resigning from the jobs. I've been calling that since late September, last September, the great strike of the unorganized workforce. You know, a strike is simply when you withdraw your labor, withhold your labor, and that's what a lot of workers are doing. They just don't want to go back to the shitty jobs and low pay anymore. Oh, some areas they're giving increases in pay to get people back, you know, in tech and so forth, where they can afford it. And at the very low end, trying to get some service workers back, they're trying, you know, they're raising the minimum wage a little bit in certain states. But that's it. You know, people just aren't coming back to work. A lot of people retired early, etc. But I'm not going to talk about that. Next week, we'll pick that one up. The job market. What I want to talk about is what's going on with the economy and all this talk about recession. You know, mainstream economists are missing it once again. You know, the pundits, economists and pundits are talking about, oh, recession 2023. I've been saying for some months now, no, fourth quarter 22. That's when we're going to see it earlier. You know, the Fed cannot raise rates that fast, that high, without precipitating a recession, which is happening. Okay, let's talk about, is it happening? First of all, we got to clarify, what is a recession? You know, the rule of thumb that the average public defines a recession with is called a technical recession. In other words, two consecutive quarters of GDP contraction. Okay, in the first three quarters of this year, January to March, we had a minus 1.6% contraction. That may not sound like much, but it really is pretty significant. You know, when you get normal recessions, you know, you're getting 3 to 5% contraction of the economy. That's trillions of dollars, of course. 1.6% negative contraction is significant. Oh, but when that occurred here in the first quarter of this year, economists were saying, oh, well, you know, that's a one-off kind of a thing, because most of it is due to what's called net exports, which is really exports minus imports. The total amount of U.S. exports that quarter to the rest of the world means production of goods in the U.S. that are then sent offshore minus imports to the U.S., from producers offshore. Now, that's not production that occurred in the U.S., that occurred offshore. So you got to subtract that production and imports from offshore to the U.S. from what was produced in the U.S., sold to the rest of the world. And we chronically have a big gap between imports and exports. We import a hell of a lot more than we export. So that becomes a negative number, the difference between the two. And that gets subtracted from GDP. That's the way it works. So if you have a trade deficit, a gap, in other words, between imports and exports, which we always do, that's going to subtract from any positive growth we have elsewhere in GDP. And what are the different areas of expenditure GDP? Well, manufacturing produced in the U.S., okay, that's about 12% of GDP. Construction in the U.S., that's about 8%, roughly divided between what's called residential housing construction, about 4-4.5%, and the rest is commercial property construction, private and public. Private meaning, you know, building malls and office buildings and so forth. Public meaning local government constructing things, roads and even buildings. And even the federal government has some construction public expenditure, you know, building military bases and so forth. Okay, so that's 8% construction, 12% manufacturing. The rest of the economy, 80%, is services, right? Now, consumer spending is about 68% of GDP. Okay, 20%, just to recap here, for construction, housing, commercial property, 12% for manufacturing, 20%. That's what's called the goods producing sector. We're producing, you know, actual things that you buy. Services aren't actual things, they're services. And that's everything from educational services, you know, to lodging services, you know, personal services of various kinds, you know, auto repair services, services, utilities. Services are a big, big thing of the U.S. economy. And that's where most of consumption occurs. It's in services. Consumer spending almost, say, 70%. Now, about half of that consumer spending is what's called retail sales. You go out and buy the, you know, the goods at the store. You know, or you go into a restaurant. That's retail sales. And that's about half of consumer spending. Okay, so consumption is the big thing. And then the fourth element is called government spending. That's, you know, anywhere between 20 and 24% of the economy. And then you got net exports, exports over imports, which comes in minus, subtracts from consumption and government spending, right? And that's how you get GDP. And if that contracts in any of those categories, you know, investment, business investment is in there as well. That breaks down into investing in equipment, investing in structures, investing in inventories. And then this smudge factor called software and intellectual property, which they added in 2013, intellectual property, which is just bogus. You know, that's stuff like the government asking a business, what's the value of your business logo? Oh, and a company throws a figure out there to make it look good that they're doing better. Well, that's nonsense. Your trademark, your business logo, your research and development activity, which is really previous to 2013, a cost, not a contribution to GDP. Okay, well, I've talked about, you know, the phony stuff that went on in 2013 added about $500 billion a year to GDP. But GDP, as I said, is only what they call a technical indicator of recession. Two consecutive quarters, a contraction of the economy. But that's not what the final formal declaration of a recession is. The final decision on what's a recession, did it occur, not occurs after the fact, 6 months or whatever, after the fact. And that is determined by this group of elite economists, the club, who are members of what's called this quasi-government agency called the National Bureau of Economic Research, and they get together and they decide whether there was a recession or not a recession. They're very conservative about it. And they look at GDP, but they also look at, well, you know, are there layoffs? What's the employment picture? What's the retail sales picture? What's the industrial production picture? What's going on with imports, exports? They look at the whole thing. It's kind of an eclectic, it's not very quantitative in the sense that there is, quote, a threshold where you add up all those economic indicators that says, oh, recession. No, it's very subjective. They agree or they don't agree. It's a recession. You know, that's the formal definition of whether a recession occurred. But the technical recession is two consecutive quarters of decline in GDP. GDP is considered by the NBER economists, but it's not the only indicator. Now, here's a real oxymoron element of how recessions are defined in the U.S. I've always had a problem with this. A recession occurs so long as the economy keeps contracting. It's got to continue to contract. If it stops contracting, even if it's 10, 20% below what it was, the recession's over. Say it contracted 10% one quarter, and then the next quarter it stopped contracting, but it only grew 1%. Oh, so it's still 9% down, isn't it? No, it's over. They don't count the time it takes to recover all that was lost. It may take 6 months, 12 months to get backed up to that level of GDP and indicators which occurred just before the recession began. That's why in 2020, you know, when we had the big shutdown, the COVID shutdown, the economy contracted dramatically that quarter, that April to June, but it stopped contracting in the next quarter, July to September. It didn't really recover that huge contraction, but it stopped contracting. So they said, oh, it was only a recession of one quarter. That was the NBER economist. Yeah. So, you know, you got to understand a little bit about these statistics here, you know. And in general, U.S. statistics are designed to lowball and give a conservative estimate of the negative developments in the economy. The same thing with inflation. You know, they lowball it. They don't count a lot of things. They have different rules that minimize, smooth out the inflation so it's not as high as it appears. The same thing when you have deflation, when prices are contracting. They minimize that contraction. In other words, they try to make it very conservative and as stable and as possible. It doesn't mean that they ignore that there's inflation or deflation. No, they just lowball it and, you know, make the fluctuations not as dramatic. The same thing with unemployment. They do the same thing. There are techniques for minimizing the unemployment numbers. They lowball it. We've talked about that many times. You know, they keep reporting the U-3 unemployment rate, not even their own U-6 unemployment rate, which gives you an unemployment rate twice the level of what they report in the media. And that's even their numbers. And that's even an underestimation of unemployment. But the point here is that all these government statistics are designed to conservatively estimate the wide swings in the economy, whether they're boom swings or bust swings. And GDP is the same thing, right? Okay, so that's GDP, technical recession. Are we already in a technical recession? well, mainstream economists up to now have been saying, oh, a recession, only 25% probability in a recession. Well, now with the figures that just came out the last couple of days, they've upped that to 40%. Ooh, 40%. We're not there. There's a 40% chance we're there. But wait a minute. The economy contracted 1.6% in the first quarter. And you know what? GDP is going to contract again in the second quarter, April to June. Yeah. Well, that's going to be two consecutive quarters. That's a technical recession. There's this indicator by the Federal Reserve, one of its 12 districts, the Atlanta district, does this shadow GDP estimate. And that shadow GDP by the Atlanta Fed was, minus 1.2% for the second quarter a couple weeks ago. Minus 1.2%. Remember, minus 1.6 the first quarter, minus 1.2% the second quarter. But, oh, they just upped that with the latest data coming in to minus 1.5%. Yeah. Minus 1.5%. Whoop. Whoop. Wait a minute. That's the latest, right? That's the latest based upon July 8th. Now, wait a minute. We're 2 weeks after July 8th, right? Yeah. July 8th. So the next report will probably come out even lower. Even lower. And there's one of the districts of the country. See, the Fed is broken into 12 districts. Different regions of the country have their own district Federal Reserve Bank. And one of them is the Mid-Atlantic Bank, located in Philadelphia, Federal Reserve District. Right? And that district is considered kind of a harbinger because of the particular mix of business that it has. You know, it's not all concentrated in one kind of industry, tech industry or whatever, you know. And the Mid-Atlantic Fed is estimating a very, very sharp contraction in the Mid-Atlantic area. A very sharp contraction. I mean, we're talking about a big contraction coming over the next 6 months in that particular region. Well, is that a harbinger of what's going on? Could be. But the worst contraction since that second quarter, 2020, when everything got shut down. There's another indicator here that's flashing warning signs of the U.S. recession. And that's what's called Purchasing Managers Index. The U.S. government surveys purchasing managers. These are guys who work for companies, purchasing managers, you know, and they buy and sell parts and, you know, resources and so forth for their company. And of course, if the company is slowing down, they're going to buy less, right? So the Purchasing Manager Index, let's call it the PMI, is an indication of slowdown going on in business. And there's a manufacturing PMI and a services PMI. And both of them together, they got a way of adding them together, is called the composite PMI. Well, what's happening with PMI here? Well, in April, the PMIs for services, and services are always a little higher, manufacturing, we're in the mid to upper 50s. It's an index. You know, an index is a number between 0 and 100. Mm-hmm. Now, with PMIs, if the number is below 50, it means the economy is contracting. If the number is above 50, it means it's growing. Well, the PMIs last May were in the mid to upper 50s. In May, they dropped to the lower 50s, 53. Okay, economy's still growing, but that growth is slowing over the course of the spring. In June, however, they started contracting. The latest PMIs that came out for the month of June, actually it's half, 3 weeks in June and 1 week in July is the way it works. Okay, so they are 47. They're both contracting, both of them, manufacturing and services, are contracting according to PMI, purchasing managers, and a big contraction in the Mid-Atlantic region. Yeah, they're below 50. Now, globally, there are PMIs as well. Europe has PMIs for manufacturing and services, you know, so does China and Japan and so forth. Elsewhere in the world, manufacturing is more of a larger proportion of the economy. And there's such a thing called a global manufacturing PMI. Global. I think it's S&P, Standard & Poor's, estimates that. Well, in May, the global manufacturing PMI was 57, just like in the U.S. In June, it was 52.7. Oh, 53 coming down. The latest one isn't out yet for global because it takes longer to gather information, but I'll bet you it's 50 or below. Come on. China, which had estimated a GDP this year of 5.5%, is probably coming in less than 4 in GDP growth, less than 4, most optimistically, because they've been shutting down, you know, major cities and areas because of COVID. Successfully, by the way, you know, what do they have, maybe 100, 200 COVID cases in a society of 1.3 billion people? And what do we have? Hundreds of thousands every day still getting infected. Now, fortunately, you know, this BA5 Omicron is not as deadly. So people aren't dying. But the infections are rampant. We're in another wave here. And now they're talking about having people wear masks again and so forth. They're not going to do diddle, though, before the elections. And they're not going to ever shut down again. The capitalists will just let everyone who gets it severely immune, depressed, die. That's where we're at with that. But unless you're immune, depressed, you know, or you have some serious health problem, you know, it is... You know, COVID's not a terrible thing. It's like a flu. Okay, well, that's it. I don't want to go off on COVID too much here. But the point is, it's still with us. And China has the zero COVID, that is a policy that saved millions of people over there, while we have over 1 million people die over here from it because of our mismanagement. Mismanagement. The quality of the capitalist elite in this country running the show has declined dramatically in the last few decades. Dramatically. Well, just look what we got. You know, we got wacko Trump, and then we got, you know, asleep at the wheel Joe. You know, I mean, that just tells me that there's some, I mean, they can't even manage their damn global empire anymore very well. Making stupid decisions, and they're losing control. Yeah, well, politically, it's a decline in the quality. And as far as this inflation thing is concerned, They just turned it over to the Fed, you know? Okay, Fed, engineer a recession here. Bring the economy down. Destroy demand. In other words, destroy jobs and income. Therefore, spending. Take it out on the backs of the middle class and median income family folks, you know? And that'll bring inflation down. It'll destroy demand. But inflation isn't totally demand-driven. There's some demand elements in it, but it's mostly supply-driven. And guess what? The Federal Reserve raising interest rates has diddle effect on supply. And the Fed knows it. But it's the only game in town, and the politicians wash their hands. They threw it all, the pot potato, in the hand, you know, in the lap of the Fed. So you do it. Engineer a recession. And Biden goes running around talking about, you know, what he's doing, you know, crude oil prices. That's all nonsense. We talked about that. That's all PR. That's all marketing to make it look like he's doing something. They know the only way to get it down is the Fed. And you know what? The Fed is working. The economy is slowing because of these rapid increases, huge increases in interest rates. And the next one's coming up next week. The Fed will raise its benchmark rate that affects all other interest rates in the economy by another 75 basis points, which is 0.75%. It just did that 0.75. It's going to do it again. It's going to do it again when we're already in a recession, a technical recession. Can you believe that? They're raising rates at a rapid record rate right into the teeth of the recession. Yeah, because they know inflation's really hot and they got to really do something drastic to bring it down. So they're going to keep pumping those rates up to bring it down. But you know what? I'm making a forecast here. They will whack out demand and that will reduce inflation some, but the supply forces that are also driving inflation will continue. So that inflation is not coming down to 2%. It's coming down maybe 4 to 5%. It's going to be significant going forward in 23, right in the middle of a recession. That's called stagflation, folks. Stagflation. Inflation and stagnant. Actually, not just stagnant, but negative contraction. The technical recession, already here, will soon morph into an NBR-defined recession. You're going to see unemployment start rising. We're already seeing a creeping up of the unemployment claims in the last 2 or 3 months. And that's just beginning. You can see what's coming in the tech sector, kind of a leading sector in the economy. The tech sector already freezes in layoffs plan in tech. It will spill over to other areas of manufacturing and then in addition to the services sector. That's the way it always works, you see. It doesn't start everywhere all at once. You know, it begins in certain sectors and then it deepens into the other sectors. But the Fed's going to whack the economy. It is whacking the economy. And it is slowing it down. Yes. And some inflation will abate. But it won't be all inflation. Because it's the supply side. You know, it's they never really resolved the supply chain problems. They've improved them a little bit here and there, but they haven't resolved them. They've still got a supply problem going on with a lot of goods and even services. You know, supply means you can't get workers to come back. Airlines, good example of that, right? They can't get people to come back to work for various reasons. Oh, the great attrition. No, the great strike of the ununionized labor force in America, withholding their labor still in certain sectors. By the way, talk about union here. Let me digress, you know. Keep a close eye on what's going on right now in union negotiations in in transport. We've got 115,000 railroad workers who are poised to go on strike. Would have gone on strike 2 weeks ago if it wasn't for the president intervening quietly and saying, oh, no, you guys can't strike. The Railway Labor Act of 1926 says that the government can intervene and can stop a strike planned, you know, prevent a strike for a certain period of time, a cooling off period, right? And then the government steps in to see if they can get the both parties to agree, mediation, it's called, federal mediation, to prevent an actual walkout. But 115,000 railroad workers are already poised to do it, already voted to walk out. And by the way, they walked out in Canada and in the UK. We're beginning to see the pressure of this record inflation whacking real wages and real income, and those who can, who have unions, responding. Saying, hey, we want to recoup at least what inflation's taken from us.
Other people.
So transport workers.
My guest now in this segment
are walking out everywhere.
Is Mary Grant.
Railway
she is
workers.
The public walker. Other people.
Yeah. And bus drivers in
now
the UK
in this segment
and so forth. They're walking out everywhere. And they still have some power because you can't offshore those jobs, you see. You can offshore manufacturing, steel and autos and so forth, but you can't offshore transport. And they still got unions, and now they're exercising their right. And it's not just railway workers poised here. It's West Coast dock workers, longshore workers, ILWU. In negotiations right now, and have been for some time, and their contract has expired, but they're still negotiating. They could walk out any time. But the government has given them a big warning, you see. Joe Biden has already met with the union months ago, pleading, but I'm sure threatening indirectly, politely, don't you walk out and worsen our supply chain problem at the port. They're leaning on the union really heavy. You can bet on that. Trying to force the union to agree to something it doesn't want to agree that management's proposed. Management's proposing a big technology, artificial intelligence investment that will eliminate lots of jobs on the docks. And the union's trying to deal with that. But if workers think their jobs are going to be taken by technology, well, they may feel, you know, what do I got to lose? You're going to take my job anyway. So we got the dock workers. I don't know, there's like 20,000 of them maybe on the West Coast, all up and down the West Coast. L.A.'s the biggest port for import entry in the country. They may go out too. Transport. And then next year, you got the Teamsters. Yeah, with UPS and some of the other big contracts coming up with a new leadership in the Teamsters elected for the first time from below. Well, maybe not the first time, but elected on a slate of reform. We haven't seen that since the 1990s when Ron Kerry got elected, walked them out at UPS in a big historic strike that the Teamsters won. And immediately the government went after them, yeah, with the company, and got them. Forced them out. Ron Kerry, yeah. Brought in this guy, Jimmy Hoffa Jr., who never worked a day as a Teamster before, was a lawyer, but had the name Hoffa, and the government put him in, and, you know, he's been sitting on the union ever since. Anyway, I don't want to get into the union stuff. We'll get into that because something's going to break, you see? Something's going to break in union negotiations here. But if it has to do with transport, then the government will invoke what's called the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. That act was designed to stop labor strikes, you know, before they even got going. They took away strike power from the union. They took away the union's ability to engage in sympathy strikes, right? They took away the union's being able to engage in boycotting non-union or striking on behalf of another union in support. They took that away, you know? And they also instituted in industries that had a national security impact, the government could step in and cool off. In other words, you can't go back to work for 30 days and government's going to jump into negotiations and bend arms. Yeah. Well, that was based on the 1926 Railway Act, you see, that I mentioned earlier. Oh, it worked for the railroad transport. Well, let's, you know, just use Taft-Hartley here and make it work for all the rest. Yeah, okay, so also, by the way, Taft-Hartley, it banned union hiring halls. If it didn't exist already, you know, they sort of grandfathered in hiring halls and longshore and the docks and so forth. But they banned them, made them outlaw. Why? Because, you know, if you got a union hiring hall, the workers got to come to the union to get their job. They don't go to the employer to get a job. The employer comes to the union and says, oh, I need so many workers here. Please send them to me. And the workers sign up with their union, and they go to the hiring hall, and they have a process where, you know, who's highest on the list. If a company comes in and says, I need so many workers, okay, we send them at the top of the list, and then the rest moves up. You know, it's a fair system. And then if you're laid off, you know, by one company and you want another job with another company, well, then you come in at the bottom of the list and you sit there in a hiring hall a day or two until you get called out. Well, you know, when the union has control of your job like that, who's your loyalty to? It's to the union, not to the damn employer. Oh, employers didn't like that. No. That's why they really lobbied hard to get the hiring hall taken out in the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. Also, unions were unionizing foremen. Oh, no, those guys are management. You can't, you know, they're our eyes and ears. They are foremen, you know, management, eyes and ears in the workforce. They tell us, you know, what's really going on and what will work to, you know, discourage people or who are the militants we should pick off. You know, that's what the foremen do. Well, if they're in the union, they're not going to do that. So that was another part of Taft-Hartley in 1947. Now, by the way, Taft-Hartley Act that stopped union organizing on a mass scale, growing, you know, union ranks. And after that, the growth of union membership was mostly because industries were increasing, you know, steel and auto in the 50s, 60s, 70s were growing in number, so that union membership grew there. And then there were new areas that were outside Taft-Hartley and the Labor Management Act that grew and unionized, like hospitals, they're outside. Public workers, they're outside. Public employment, cities, counties, states, whatever. Yeah, that's where all the growth occurred, outside, and even agriculture for a while in the 70s. That's outside the rules and regulations of Taft-Hartley and the Labor Management Act, of which Taft-Hartley was a big amendment to that act, you see. And they controlled it. Controlled labor, stopped it in its tracks. You know, the gains of the 30s and the 40s abruptly. Now, I didn't say this wasn't growth. There was growth, you know, in the public employment sector, unionizing, you know, hospitals and so forth. There was growth in those sectors, and there was some growth in industry growing. But their membership in basic industry got totally whacked out in the 80s. with Reagan and neoliberalism. What happened? A number of things happened that pretty much destroyed the private sector unions, except for transport and some services. Yeah. Well, what happened? Well, they offshored most of it. Yeah, they offshored a lot of the jobs. All the goods-producing manufacturing jobs got offshored. Well, that whacked the membership. Another thing they did was in transport, they deregulated it. Deregulated transport. So a lot of other new startup companies came in. Lower wages, non-union wages, big pressure on the unionized transport to lower their wages or not give wage increases. And that whacked out some of the membership and certainly the wages. If you look at today's wages, truck drivers, if they were making adjusted for inflation, what they were making before this deregulation occurred, in other words, in the late 70s, early 80s, if they were making what they were making in real income today, what they were making then, their average pay, all truck drivers, today would be over $100,000. It's really around $50,000. Yeah. And the membership collapsed, of course, in the major industries, the auto, steel, collapsed. And membership was lost in the Teamsters Union, too. Teamsters Union at one time was over 2 million members. Okay, so that's the digression on labor that, you know, we should keep in mind here. Let's get back to the U.S. economy and recession. But the point I want to leave you with is that watch what's happening as those still unionized say, hey, you know, we're not going to see our real income contract 10% a year. We got a union. We're going to fight back. And the government is going to do everything they can to co-opt the leadership of those unions, everything they can to prevent strikes, everything they can to reduce the settlements on behalf of the employers. The state, the capitalist state, comes in crises, you know, on behalf of the capitalists against the unions and workers. Of course, you got no union, you're in deep shit, because whatever income you got is being whacked at least 10% a year. Last year, even more this year, and continuing next year. You know, over the course of 18 months, you're going to find your real income down 25%. A lot of these people are living on paycheck to paycheck. How the hell are they going to survive? I don't know. Well, they need to unionize, maybe. And we see that going on, don't we? Yeah. Amazon and other places. Yeah, we'll see more of that. Okay, so let's get back to, you know, the U.S. recession here, right? Manufacturing now contracting, 12% of the economy. Construction, residential housing, commercial property. Well, commercial property is a basket case. Nothing going on. I mean, no one's building new malls or new office buildings. Hell, they can't even fill the office buildings. People are leaving it in droves, leaving the offices in inner cities saying, I had enough of this, right? And trying, and many of them successfully working remotely. That means you're going to have a lot of defaults going on in these real estate trusts in these cities. Big investors there. You know, the Donald Trumps, all those guys speculating, making money off of money. Yeah, well, okay, you know, malls and theme parks, right? Office buildings. No, you're not going to see any of that expanding. On the housing side, which is half of construction, of course, now we see all kind of indicators of contraction going on in real production there as well. Housing starts are down, permits to build housing are down, contracting, other indicators, you know. Forget all this sale of existing houses, you know, which is over half of real estate, residential real estate, existing home sales, right? Refinancing. That has absolutely no contribution to GDP because it's a used good. And when you resell a used good, it doesn't go into the calculation to GDP. You know, you sell your used car, that doesn't go into GDP. Only a new car goes into GDP. You can't double count, you see, for GDP. So anything that's used and is resold has no effect on GDP and growth. It's just paper. Yeah. Okay. So construction and housing, commercial property, flat, negative. Residential housing, you know, single family, multifamily, you know, that's contracting now. So the goods sector, manufacturing and construction goods, are both going south. And that brings us to consumer spending, the big one, right? That's flattening out. Consumer spending is flattening out. Retail sales, big part of consumer spending. Oh, they came out with the numbers a few, I think it was last week. Yeah, last week. Big deal, you know. Retail sales beat expectations. You know, subheader, manufacturing slumps. Okay, but the focus was on retail sales. All right. Oh, big increase in retail sales. Rose 1% last month in June. 1%, oh, 12% a year. 8.4% year on year, right? Compared to last year. 8.4% rise over the past year in retail sales. But they don't tell you retail sales are not adjusted for inflation. So if inflation is 9.1% the last 12 months and retail sales is 8.4%, well, then, you know, it's pretty clear that most of the retail sales contribution to consumption GDP is all inflation. It's all price increases. Therefore, real retail sales that go into GDP are pretty much flat. And that's the biggest component of consumer spending. So consumer spending is mostly flat. And it's going to go down as the Fed raises rates and destroys demand by laying people off and reducing their wages and their income. So add it up, folks. You know, okay, manufacturing down, housing construction down, retail sales flat, on the way down because consumer index here, the consumer sentiment index for Michigan, right? It was only 50. It's an index, right? So below 50 means consumers are seeing a contraction. Above 50 means they're seeing growth. Well, that's flat as well, along with retail sales. Consumer spending, retail sales, flat. 66% of the economy, flat. And going down. Net exports, still more imports over exports as China slows, as Europe slows. Where the hell's the growth coming from? Oh, the government's going to spend more, going to buy more missiles from Raytheon, I guess, you know, and send them over to Ukraine, right? Because we're not going to get any more social spending. Joe Manchin, the president 2.0, has already said that, right? Forget that. Yeah. He's not even going to agree to let the government, Medicare, negotiate with the big pharma companies to bring some of that running amok pharma costs down. Most important, insulin. We have millions of people in this country dependent on insulin, and they are gouging the hell out of everybody who needs insulin for diabetes, raising the prices. You know how many times pharma has raised prices over the past year? All these pharma companies, you know, they get a lot of products, right? They've raised prices on over 1,800 products. Sometimes two and three times. Insulin, life and death. You go to Canada and other places, it's cheap. They're just screwing their own people. They don't care. Yeah, big pharma. Price gouging. Big monopolistic companies and industries price gouging the hell out of us, from pharma to the oil companies. Even the chicken producers are doing it. Yeah. Gouging the hell out of us. One of the fastest growing prices is chickens and eggs. Been at a grocery store, bought a dozen eggs lately? Yeah. Chicken and eggs. Anyway, you know, what we got is an economy that is slipping fast. And it's not just the U.S. Go abroad. Go abroad. Same thing. You got the same thing going on. PMIs in Europe contracting. Especially Germany, which is the heart of Europe. Yeah. Inflation, about 8.5%, 9% officially, just like the U.S., but it's going up because of the damn sanctions. You see, the sanctions are only now beginning to bite. Before, energy prices were rising because of, you know, the global commodities markets rising. But inflation in Europe, you know, 42% of it is energy related, which is mostly sanctions related. Yeah, now they're finally implementing sanctions on Russian oil, and supposedly they're going to have that, you know, totally removed by December. Where are they going to get their oil? You know, Joe Biden just talked to Venezuela, and he said, please, Maduro, President Maduro, can you send some oil to our friends in Europe? And of course, Maduro says, sure, we got lots of good oil. If you Yankees don't want it, we'll send it to Europe. The Yankees don't want it. The Yankees won't even increase production from their own oil wells. They want to keep the supply of oil companies tight so they keep the prices up. Yeah. So, you know, and then Joe Biden, President 1.0, goes over to Saudi Arabia, right? Goes over to Saudi Arabia, and he says, hey, Bin Salman, good buddy, fist bump, right? Good buddy, you know. We'll forget the fact that you hacked the American journalist for Washington Post, Khashoggi, that you chopped him up, had your guy, your henchman, chop the poor bastard up. You know, we'll forget that. You know, just give us some more oil. And then Joe leaves without an agreement in hand that the Saudis will increase their oil production. Yeah, he walks away. He got nothing. Empty pockets. And then the Saudis a day or two later said, no, we're not going to really increase it. I mean, what kind of desperation, what kind of capitalist political management is that? They go over there and they don't already have an agreement that they can announce. He goes over there and he pleads with them? Walks away with nothing? Egg on his face? That's Joe. That's Joe Biden. Yeah. Boy, this is incompetent, even from their own interests, an incompetent administration. Yeah. I think they also went over there to plan how the hell they're going to go after Iran, you see. There's a new axis forming, and that is Israel, U.S., and the Saudis. How are we going to go after Iran? I mean, Israelis are already bombing the shit out of Damascus, Syria. They already got a war going there. I mean, this is all designed to open another front for the Russians, you know, while they're busy in the Ukraine. Oh, another front, you know. Yeah. They tried, by the way, to open another front in Lithuania, you know, by blocking, shutting down the road from Russia, Belarus, to the Russian enclave there on the Baltic called Kaliningrad, right? Sort of stuck between Lithuania and Germany. It's a military base of importance in the Baltic for the Russians, and the Lithuanians wanted to shut it down to provoke the Russians to, militarily try to reopen it. The Russians too smart for that. They got Germany to put some pressure on Lithuania. You know, the Baltic's got some radical right nutcases running the show over there. Poland's not far behind. But in any event, Germany put pressure. No, we don't want another conflict on our doorstep with Russia here. Right. So, but they're provoking. They're trying to provoke Russia in different ways. Right? And I think opening a second front in the Middle East is part of that. And that's really why Biden went over there. You could probably give more jets to Saudi Arabia to bomb Yemen with. But he sure didn't come back with any kind of deal on oil. No, so the oil prices are going to stay relatively high and will only come down as consumers, you know, stop driving, which they're doing, you know. But prices have come down, you know, minimally. You know, here in California, it was $7 a gallon. Okay, now it's $6.40. Whoopee. You know, 2 years ago, it was $4. Yeah. Okay, so consumer spending, Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index, stagnant, flat. Mid-Atlantic area, contracting sharply here. Retail sales, all price increases, no real growth there. Folks, the recession is here. Technically, it's here, and in all other non-technical definitions, it will be here by the fourth quarter. Yeah, but that's what our folks in the mainstream economics profession is saying. Oh no, you know, we got another 6 to 9. We got another 9 months here. They've been wrong on inflation being chronic. They've been wrong on just about everything, because the problem with professional mainstream economists is they forecast the present, not the future. They're too cowardly to take a risk, ruin their careers, by stepping out and saying, well, where is this going? So they all look at each other and say, well, who's got the mainstream consensus? Oh, I'll join the consensus. Yeah, that's how they forecast. Okay. Well, anyway, I think we're close to the end of our allotted time here on the show. Going to be able to pick up the rest. So we're heading for a global recession, certainly in the U.S. recession, here within the next 6 months. We may already be there. Okay? All right, so don't put any money in the stock market. If you want to, buy some government bonds. Buy some government bonds, because the prices of those are going to rise here as the recession deepens. Okay, I got the signal. We're through. I'm out of here. Next week. I've seen it hard and said, well, so-